I'm Caroline Robinson, Mill Valley resident, and sitting here by Linda Chittenden, whom I first met when my oldest child was entering fifth grade.
In what year?
Oh my.
1967.
Right in the height of activity in Mill Valley, and of the height of a renaissance in the school system of Mill Valley. Okay. Linda, tell us how you first arrived in Mill Valley.
Okay. I had never been to Mill Valley, but Jim Collins, who was then the newly hired superintendent of schools, I had known well for many years. He had, in a way, he and his wife, Mary Collins, taught me everything I knew about how to be a teacher.
Let's backtrack a little bit, just basic, like, thumbnail, where you were born, where you went to college, first teaching job,
okay,
and where you were at this point.
I was living in Los Angeles. I went to L.A. State to get an elementary teaching credential. It was a terrible program. Terrible. It was the most mediocre, pedestrian, uncreative. What we were being, I can, one illustration. I can remember going in with the class, it was art and methods. And we all sat in little chairs in the demonstration school on the campus at LA State. The teacher was in, all the children were in desk in rows. The teacher in the front was teaching them this art lesson. It was about an urban landscape that they were drawing. So he taught them to do rectangles with L's in it for windows and little birds. And all the kids drew exactly the same thing that he was doing in it. And that was being shown to us as what we should be learning to do. We should be doing that with our students when we got them. At the same time that I was an undergraduate there, I was working, because I came from a very blue-collar working-class family. Nobody in my family had ever been to college, and I needed to earn money. So I was working at an elementary school nearby, not far away, and Jim was the principal. Jim and Mary were then getting their PhDs at Claremont Graduate School. As in my job, I was a teacher's assistant to the upper grade team of teachers that were doing extraordinary things. So I learned how to be a teacher from my job in that school, which was in a way kind of a demonstration school for Claremont Graduate School. It was such a contrast. So I worked there all through college, and my first teaching job was in Jim's school. As soon as I graduated, I began teaching there. Then Jim left, got his first administration job beyond being principal. He got an assistant superintendent's job in Lafayette up here. At the same time in my life, I wanted to leave LA. So I moved to Berkeley. And just as Jim became assistant superintendent, and he gave me a job there. And it was terrible. Can you imagine an elementary, third and fourth grade, that was departmentalized and homogeneously grouped? So for each grade level, I was a third and fourth grade language arts teacher. So these poor kids were divided into low, medium, and high, and had to move from classes to classes to go to math, to go to history, to go there. It was terrible. I hated it. So I only taught there 1 year, and I got an NDA grant. Johnson was president, and there was lots of money in those NDA grants. So I got
what's NDA?
National Defense Education Act. And it gave money to, I mean, I just made an application, got a grant for graduate school, everything paid. And then in that time, Jim stayed one more year in Lafayette. He hated it too. And then he got hired in Mill Valley. And I was going to work in Berkeley because that's where Neil Sullivan was the new superintendent. He was integrating the schools, and it was a very dynamic place. I did not want suburb. Lafayette had so turned me off suburbs. And that's where I was going to teach. And
so was Jim a superintendent? Or
he then, were, yeah, he got hired as the superintendent here in Mill Valley on a Monday night. He called me Tuesday morning, and he said, you have a job, and you can have any class you want, and you can close the door, and you can do what you want. And Berkeley was just, I got offered jobs there, but there were all of these very dynamic, smart black principals that Neil Sullivan had hired, and they came in like this with their plans, and it was full of pullouts. They would pull kids out for this and that program, lots of intervention. And I didn't want that. I want a class of heterogeneously grouped kids, preferably multi-graded, and let me do what I know how to do. And Jim offered me that. And I, of course I wanted it, but I still had never been to Mill Valley. And while I was in graduate school, I had all my teaching stuff stored at my father's, and he borrowed a pickup, and we put it all in there, and we drove to Mill Valley. It was my first time ever being here. I was already had the job, and I remember we pulled into town, and then we immediately ended up in the parking lot at the depot. We didn't know how to get out of there. And we found our way to Old Mill School. And just unpacked my stuff.
The rest is history.
And so that's all I knew when I came in and started. Now, I did discover, and this is something that Caroline knows a whole lot about because her husband was on the school board at that time. And what was happening in the school board between quasi-conservative. I mean,
Who's a quasi-conservative?
Well, semi-conservative. There was a conservative force and a progressive force.
Use names.
But who was the conservative, relatively conservative representative on the board?
Oh, I don't know.
I thought they all were pretty...
They were progressive, but within the community, I mean. It was the progressive board that hired Jim.
Yes.
And then...
But the town was split. Was diverse.
Not yet. Oh. Right. The town got split.
But it was diverse.
It was... Well, you know more. I don't. Yeah. I didn't. But the first thing... After hiring Jim, they hired someone named Dave Erskine as the principal at Old Mill. And he, in retrospect, I can see he was very ambitious. He was compatible philosophically with what Jim wanted to do, what Jim's wife, Mary Collins, who was a teacher educator and went on to do amazing things in the Petaluma schools. They just let me do what I wanted to do. And
Linda, I think you were hired as a model for a new direction for the schools. Nobody knew what the new direction was, but Dave Erskine and you were to put down in clay what the dream was of superintendent.
Do you agree with that?
I was unaware of it at the time.
Do you think there's truth?
It's probably.
In essence, that's what it was. Because nobody knew the future. All we knew is that there was a group in Mill Valley, mostly fairly recent rivals, who didn't want to continue the education you described mm-hmm. from the 50s that we hired from, we inherited from the 50s with the children in the role, because we felt the world was changing and that education didn't teach children how to adapt to change.
Okay. And yes. The first thing that I did was get rid of all the desks.
This is 1967, you said,
yes,
right?
Okay. Yes. Get rid of all the desks, and instead there were tables.
What grade did you have? I'm not sure if you said that.
I think, it was no straight grade. It was fourth and fifth, and then what I don't recall is how quickly Dave started putting other grade levels in there, if it was the first year, or I think I started with fourth and fifth, and then I think Dave brought in a few third graders. And by the next year, he brought in some second graders. So I had second through fifth. But then those kids who had been fifth didn't want to leave. So we said, okay, you get to do sixth grade here if you want. They didn't want to go to the middle school.
Oh, they didn't have to go to the middle school?
Well, later they had to. But at that time, no. And so it probably wasn't until the second year, I had second through sixth, and almost 40 students, and lots of help. Every mother, every parent, PTA, I mean, all you guys came in and helped. There were no teacher aides then, but I had a whole schedule.
I remember these wonderful single mothers who were on welfare who were artists and came in and did all this art.
Oh, yeah, we had wonderful.
Because we had little cabins in the valley that people could live, struggling artists could live in.
Yeah.
And they all came and gave to the school.
Oh, yes. I mean, I remember serious, earnest discussions on how the school should not be just the walls of that building down there, that within the whole community, kids should be able to, if they're interested in learning something about building and a dad or family or building, and there's a kid who wants to work a few days helping them, that should be okay. I'm not sure we ever got quite that far.
But I remember we had a sculptor who came and taught everybody sculpting, uh-huh. including the parents.
Yeah. So there was...
So you got rid of the desks, just put tables in.
Tables and couches. We would pick up couches from anybody who would give us. Lots of... Always a rug, couches... And pillows, those great big, what were they called? They were very much in vogue then. So people would give us hand-me-downs.
Oh, these huge pillows that were twice the size of your body.
Right. And kids would lay on them and curl on them. And instructionally, at that time, and I am not in any way saying it's the way to do it. It's what we were doing at the time. And it's...
Who's we?
Myself and anybody else that was part of our school, our philosophy. It was individualized instruction with contracts for doing the work. Now, I wouldn't do it that way now, because there are instructional difficulties. Some kids need more direct instruction than they were getting, and that was a problem. In retrospect, we were very much about being a community. It was very much about empowering students and taking them very seriously.
I might add that Dave Erskine and Linda and others were empowering us mothers in the PTA, because we were the first generation of mothers who were college graduates but did not work. And we were frustrated. And Mr. Erskine and Linda and others opened us up to be part of something that mattered, the school, mm-hmm. our children's schooling.
And I remember one of the first things I learned from Dave was his message to parents that you are responsible for your child's education. He invited parents in, mm-hmm. in ways that weren't being done.
And we ate it up, us, because we had roles as mothers, but we had been to college, and we wanted more. And this was an opportunity to be a mm-hmm. stay-at-home mother and also matter.
But part of what, for me, was important, and that I may not have for the next 30 years done completely individualized instruction with learning contracts and all of that. I found other ways, better ways to structure the curriculum. But what never changed, I mean, my last year of teaching in 1997, I still began every day with a classroom meeting. From the very beginning of the year, the day begins with a class meeting. There is a class chairperson. There is a vice chairperson. There are roles for every student. I mean, there are offices. There's the one who collects the homework and checks that out. And so that giving the students responsibilities for the classroom, it's to me very, very important and very much a part of upper grades 4th and 5th in particular, that that class is self-contained. It's the last time they will ever be in a self-contained classroom. And they can experience and work through community issues in a way they'll never be able to do again in school. And they love it.
What?
They love it. Yeah. I hadn't figured out to do it then, but something that became later was a truth box. I found an old Army surplus ammo box at this Army surplus in Marin, remember that? Mm-hmm. And some guy there, I don't know what kind of machine he had to use to burn up an opening in it so paper could be stuck in it. And it has a very elaborate lid, and to take it off is elaborate. So that was the truth box. And the truth box sat over someplace. And you could write complaint. You could make a complaint about somebody else, but you had to sign it. Or you could make an apology unsigned, or an appreciation unsigned. And it was a way to get at all that underground stuff that goes on. Here we did it through just discussions and the items on the agenda, but this would really got at it. And maybe only once a week or every week and a half, the truth box would be opened. We'd all sit in a circle on the rug, open up the truth box, and these papers would come out all folded up, usually in an origami something, or folded up. And I would... But you had to label on the outside, was it a complaint or an apology? Or
did you read all of them, or some of them you
Well, I would
out?
Pile them out, and I would put the complaints in one pile, and they were always mostly complaints, and then the other things would come last. And they would spell them compliance. And I would open it, and I would make eye contact with the kid that wrote it. This is your last chance to withdraw it. And read it. And so I would read it. And it's about rotten behavior on the classroom or teasing or something like that was usually what it is. So, and then the kid who did the complaint would add more if needed. Then the kid named in the complaint got to have a say. and then anybody who else who was there. And I always ended up maybe on with an apology or a promise not to do it again for a while. And I mean, I even got, I got called in on the truth box. I got a complaint in the truth box once because I had teased in a way that hurt somebody's feelings, and I had to apologize. But I don't know, I'm rambling. But that...
It's so relevant to the bullying question today.
It got at every interpersonal, psychological, working in community issue was dealt with that way. So, I mean, I just use that as an example of a philosophy that didn't change as I learned more than I knew in 1967. I did many things that were sound. Rigor, intellectual rigor was not yet part of what I built into the curriculum. That came later as I realized it was too loose.
I'm curious, you said that you took the all the desks out of your classroom. Was that a personal choice for you as an individual teacher, or did all the teachers at Old Mill do that?
No, I did it.
Okay.
And actually, in reading, that's a Pacific Sun article. I'm not sure when that was. Mrs. C is a subdivider. It's about the bloody refrigerator boxes. But part of what's in it is commentary from the kids. And there's comments from the kids saying they didn't like it when they first came in. Where's my desk? I want a desk with a lid that lifts up that I can stuff things into. And then then later they're saying, no, I like the way it is now. Anyway. But we were upstairs. The school has been rebuilt now, and this room no longer exists. But this was a huge room upstairs that Dave gave me. And how this happened, so we had all this space. And in a discussion because there were evaluative assessment discussions that went on every day. We would end the day also with kind of how are we doing, how did the day go, what do we need to change, do differently tomorrow, and so forth. The distractions, kids being distracted, was a problem. So somebody got a new refrigerator, and they brought the box in. Could I have this, and can I put a desk in this? Sure. So some kids chose to do this, and some decorated it, and then, well, you can see. But not everybody. And actually, this letter that I got from a former student, where he says, this is a kid who found that video online. As a side note, I'd like to comment on the cardboard boxes. What I remember was that the teachers encourage us to shape our environment, to create within the classroom our own space and what we needed for learning. One day, someone had a box and made his own private space within the larger classroom. We thought the boxes were great for a while, but then it got out of hand when the classroom became filled with them. As a class, we talked about how we had lost our common space and connection with one another, and they were taken down. Well, they weren't all, but some...
Was this 1 year, just 1 year?
No, this was probably a total of no more than 3 years.
Okay, after your first year when you came there in 67. Yeah. And you were the only classroom that had the cardboard boxes?
Yeah.
Okay.
But Andy is saying, but for me, the boxes were not a big part of my experience. So...
It was an experiment, experimental mode.
Very, yeah. It didn't feel experimental.
But it was, as a public school. Maybe not a private school. But
right, it didn't feel experimental to me because I had a certainty mm-hmm. That we were on the right path. We were creating something. We were creating something new, but it wasn't. I didn't think of it as an experiment.
I would imagine in American history, quite a few one-room schoolhouse teachers.
That was our model.
Did things like that.
I mean, that was in a way what I had in. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So was what was the parents' reaction to this?
Mixed.
Mixed.
There were some students who only were in my class 1 year, and then they moved. They went someplace
Linda,
else.
Would you say that Dave Erskine handpicked your students with parents that would be more open?
It, as we went along, I bet for sure he did. Mm-hmm. I was unaware of it, but he probably did. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It takes courage to do this in a public arena.
Mm-hmm.
But you had some of the kids remained in your class for a few years.
I had some kids for 4 years. And many for three. And many more for two.
This carried on as a model in the middle school. My daughter had the Tangway class, 6th, 7th, and 8th.
Yeah.
Similar.
Yeah.
So for many students, it was a very profitable way of learning. And of course, then it's elective. Parents could elect it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was your first 3 years at mm-hmm. Old Mill School. Mm-hmm. You want to comment how that morphed into the?
Well,
you were there 30 years, right?
Well, I in the district 30 years.
Oh, okay.
But Dave had this ambition of expanding what I was doing into a larger arena. And that was when we created the Learnatorium. And I named it. But he put three classes in the auditorium. And it lasted only 1 year, or I lasted in it only 1 year, because I was responsible, but there were two other teachers, one of whom was I could talk with and she understood but one and the other was a male new teacher who was spineless, and he absolutely his kids were just running wild, and he would not assert himself and be the adult in the room. And
but there were three of you teachers in this room.
In three classrooms of kids. So at the end of that year, I wanted back in my own room. Other teachers came into and carried on the Learnatorium, but I didn't.
Years did the Learnatorium go on for?
I don't know.
Do you remember the Learnatorium?
Yes. Some parents felt that it was a disaster for their children.
Yeah. And some, if they were in that class with the teacher who was spineless and not in charge and not creating what I felt needed to be created, it wasn't good for them.
Also, it's very threatening to parents that children are giving wider boundaries than the parents are comfortable with.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what we're doing. Pretty much what we were doing. But
some children were, I know one mother I can think of who felt that changed her daughter's life forever, that it made her daughter a much different person.
Positively or negatively?
In charge of her life in a very broad way. And the conclusion was that for some children it was wonderful, and other children couldn't handle it. Part of it has, perhaps, how structured the family was, the parents' attitude towards structure.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the part that used to agitate me was that people say, oh, this is completely unstructured. Where I knew there was a great deal of structure. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't so visible. And there was accountability. Not enough. I learned how to have the students be more accountable as the years went on.
Were there any standardized tests in those days to measure?
There were, but they were really easy. They were something that didn't interfere. When I say they were easy, they weren't particularly good in the sense that they measured anything important, but they were the kind of thing that any halfway bright kid could just, they were multiple choice. And
Mill Valley was a very special place during those years. There were a lot of people who really welcomed this, and it had a lot of air with all the artists to try new wide boundaries. So it was a good community for this, but it was a diverse community. So there were many parents who felt differently.
Yeah, in terms of by diversity, economic diversity, there was a lot. Yes.
And cultural. But the community as a whole was very tolerant of cultural difference. That was a unique thing about Mill Valley. We all were one community, even though we had different values. That was very, very unique. Mm-hmm. Very unique. And Old Mill was, I don't know why they picked Old Mill, except my husband was from Old Mill on the board, and we were kind of willing to try new things. Maybe that's,
Yes, meaning why did maybe they Jim saw, put Dave Erskine there,
yes,
as opposed to another
school? It's possible.
School?
So there were some, but many other schools developed very well, too. But you can imagine the split in the community. However, 4 years later, or maybe in this case 3 years later, my husband and another man ran for the board again, they had no opposition. They were accepted.
Let's go back to this. So, your room with no desks and just tables and boxes, did that just go on for 3 years, or did that continue?
No, I mean, those same tables I used all 30 years.
Okay.
They were made in San Quentin, and they had, here they are. They were half circle oak tables, and four kids could sit at them. And at that time, in the beginning, there were no assigned seats. I learned to assign seats. And kids could move. I mean, we moved desks, and we would change. But kids, I felt they really need an assigned seat.
It was good. It was for a structure.
The wandering around didn't take place when you had your own assigned
Linda,
seat.
I wondered something. A lot of the education during that time, Summerhill was very, very influential. I don't know if you know of Summerhill.
Is that a person?
No. Summerhill is a book by A.S. Neal. And it's an account written early 60s about a school in the private school. Could have been a state school, actually. In England, where there was no required curriculum and basically no required anything. And it was, at this time, we used the term self-directed. That was very, it was very important that students be self-directed. And this took it to quite an extreme. But A.S. Neal's next book was called Freedom, Not License. And
that wasn't written yet.
And it hadn't been, but he wrote it soon afterwards, because just like that young man at the first year in the Learnatorium, you just let the students be. Well, no, you don't. And that's license. Providing a structure within which to be free, but also to take responsibility. You are responsible for learning, so forth.
The children were developing an inner structure.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully. And I did look. I just was reading in my scrapbook. That was put together when I retired. But Karen, Myra and...
Wise?
Yes, Karen Wise. So I had all three of those girls. But Karen was in that first class, and here she is. And she loved to read. But in the scrapbook has letters from the forms where the kids filled out what they remember, what they liked, didn't like, or whatever. Anyway, I read...
Years later?
Yeah. Written in 1997. And somewhere is Karen's. And she talks about when it was contract time. Mm-hmm. And I would... Because I met with every kid every day. I mean, part of what... After the meetings, and we would have our discussion on what items in the agenda, then I would put up our schedule for the day. Mm-hmm. And that included what kids I needed to meet with. And every day I would meet with somebody to go over their contract, show me your portfolio of what you've accomplished this week and so forth. And Karen says, all I wanted to do is read. But I didn't want to do any math at all. But she talks about how Linda would say, I would say, okay, I'm going to do this much math. And that I would not let her get away with that. That I would nudge her and push her to do more. Anyway, she was very receptive to it. All three of the Wise girls did really well.
Linda, I hear now that in some schools, what's happening now is that they say if a child doesn't read by third grade, they're kind of out of it. They have to be held back. But that wasn't the way it was in those years.
No.
In these years Linton is talking about, the feeling was a child will exhibit their reading when they're ready.
There was an agreement, there was a belief, and give them time and the right structure, and it will happen. And there was a belief that it would happen for every kid. Now, in retrospect, there were students that should have had more intervention, more structured, focused intervention early on. Of many of these kids in these pictures, I still know. I know where they are now. I can think of a couple that we didn't do well for them. I can think of many more that are fine. But the kid that there were because of societal. There were kids and families that were kind of crumbling and had,
yes.
This was open marriage and all of that was happening.
I can make a statement about this. During this period of Mill Valley in the 60s, many families divorced. Half of my children's friends' parents divorced. A lot of them were people who married right after college. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't had a single life and someone wanted. But yes. There was drugs coming up towards the end of the 60s and the parents were experimenting with drugs. So the children were going through a very terrible time.
Yes. Those little boys right there, all three of them. That was what was happening in their lives.
They're all brothers? Or
no.
Are they three different?
The parents were experiencing also the lack of boundaries.
Yeah.
And life was halcyon here in Mill Valley. Wonderful weather. Everything was free and cheap, you know.
Yeah. So not every student thrived. And I know how I know now what I would do differently, but I wasn't the reason, the sole reason for some of those kids not thriving.
Nick, look, the observation about the times, when we had these strict schools, structured schools, private schools were like Linda is describing. But then as the public schools became more and more like Linda is describing, then private schools became more and more structured. So there seems to be some kind of a balance in life. Mm-hmm. Would you say something
like that? What was happening in the private schools was in response to what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where'd you go on after Old Mill? So talk a little more about your career.
Okay. I left the Learnatorium. I went up my own class, and I continued to have my own class. There was a period of time at Old Mill where we had a different principal every year. Every year there'd be someone different. And I remember I had no idea what even a principal is supposed to do. Pat McDonough was our principal one year, and his job, I told him finally, was to make me laugh. Every day he would come in, he would go around the school, and he would just come in and he'd tell me a joke, or he'd come behind me and whisper, "Seventh grade math." Which was, in no way was I going to teach seventh grade math at the middle school. He would always threaten to put me there. The wonderful thing for me, I don't think I would have survived any place else but here. So I don't have a strong, I'm not a rebel, but I have trouble with rules, mostly because I just don't pay attention to them. And here, both the administration and parents, if you can justify what you're doing, okay. I was left alone. Not one principal or one superintendent in the 30 years I was here ever got after me. I mean, Jim Darich would say in June, "Linda, you didn't teach electricity again this year."
To right. Fifth graders?
Yeah, that was part of the science curriculum, okay. And I always forgot. And there was the stimulation of, in the early 70s, so from those 60s then to the mid-70s, I became involved with the Bay Area Writing Project at Berkeley, and that changed my life. I learned so much, and I was one of the first, it began as a project of secondary English teachers teaching one another. The principle was good teachers should teach other teachers, not textbook. I mean, that's the way InService used to be. Textbook publishers had salespeople that go out and sell their books, and this is how you use the book. And that was part of what was, we were, our belief was not in textbooks, but in teachers. And and anyway, the writing project was very, very excellent secondary English teachers. And then as the project grew, they began to bring in a few elementary people. So I was one of the first elementary people, and it was just fabulous. And
wait, so you presented this program at the elementary schools? I'm not sure what you did with it.
Okay, part of what started, that started in 77, I think, 77, 78. you basically went, I mean, it was an 8-week summer program at Berkeley, and where you had one day where you taught everybody in that, and there were a few elementary people, middle school, there were some middle school teachers, a lot of secondary teachers, and some college instructors, and you taught them, you showed them what you do in your classroom, and then you became part of, you became a teacher consultant when the writing project would go out and do in services in schools. You were one of the consultants that were brought in during that time. So, but I learned so much from all these fabulous teachers. And I came back from the writing project summer so enthused, and I had the perfect group of kids. I had a group that I'd had most of them. By then there was just fourth and fifth. I wasn't doing second through sixth or anything like that anymore. I just had fourth and fifth. So I had all these fifth graders that I'd had as fourth graders. And we had the freedom, curriculum freedom, we spent almost the whole year writing a textbook on marine mammals for kids. At that time, there were no books for kids on marine mammals. And
you still did math and everything,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We had, but it was, I was able to, I mean, we did math, sort of classic. That would be, usually that was the only textbook I really used. Otherwise, I would create our resources for whatever curriculum we were doing, which might be a few textbooks from here and there, but they'd be other materials as well. But we spent a year as science, social studies, language arts, and we wrote this really good textbook for kids. It's over there.
Really?
Yeah.
So it was actually published and everything?
We published it ourselves. This was pre-computers.
Right.
I had one electric typewriter in the room. Actually, there's an account of that I wrote up for another book that I have. But we just wanted to study marine mammals. And to do that, we needed to go on field trips. So my aide at the time, it's a close friend, Sue Wright, and her kid was in the class, and her grandmother was a quilter. So grandma gave us a quilt to auction off, or we sold tickets for, and somebody would win it. And we raised a lot of money selling that quilt for field trips. We just wanted to take field trips. And we took field trips. God, we were learning. We brought in so many resources. Here are kids reading Rachel Carson. Here are kids reading anything from National Geographic. This was pre-National Geographic with the humpback whale songs and Roger Payne's study. And we were learning so much. So we had enough money. We brought somebody in from Greenpeace. Oh. It was so exciting. And this woman comes in very earnest, and she is prepared to tell us that there are toothed whales and there are baleen whales. Well, duh. And so she gives some simplistic, okay, 10 minutes or so of talk. The kids are sitting there like this. And at this point, I'll never forget, Jason Begley. Remember the Begley twins? Jason Begley, who by then had changed his name to Oliver Orca.
Orca.
He raises his hand as if she finishes her little spiel. Any questions? So he raises his hand and he says, when a baby baleen whale is born, how does it nurse? How does, because it's got this baleen here, how does it get the nipple in its mouth to nurse? Now, that's a really sophisticated question. And she looked at him, and she She had no idea how to answer it.
I don't either.
They pump, the mother expresses the milk.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a flap that and the breast is inside this flap, and the baby goes up to it, and I suppose there is a nipple, but anyway, the milk is expressed and gets into the...
But they're nursing in the water, I suppose.
And it doesn't get diffused.
Yeah, yeah. That woman was not able to answer one question the kids had. Their questions were so sophisticated. And so she left. I know, she cost us $50 or something. Oh, the kids were just so... exercise.
Well, that's a lesson on life.
Yes. So it was the perfect, because I'd been thinking, what am I going to do with all this? What I knew I didn't want to do from the writing project is have them write reports, the classic report where they copy from various sources and so forth. I didn't want to do that. So I wasn't sure exactly what we were going to do, but she left, and the kids are so just irritated. And I said, I don't know what can do. I think that you, anyway, the discussion was, look how much you already know. And so we, you know. And one of the things, by then we were doing lots of charting, chart paper. So I could chart, look at all this information that you have here. I think that we should write a book. Right. That's what we should do. So we brainstorm the table of contents. It was perfect. It was in the right, you know, part of teaching is manipulation only. this really difficult part, our table of contents were all questions to be answered. So each job that the kid had was simply an extended response to a question. And it just took off like. Here, I'll get the book.
Linda, is this?
Okay, okay. You were talking about the book you wrote, which is called, not that you wrote, that your class wrote.
Okay. It's Our Friends in the Waters. And again, to enable the kids to write what they know, they needed the structure of a long response to a focused question that they need to deal with the concept within the knowledge, and that what also made this very clear to them is they knew they were writing this for other kids. They weren't writing it for me as a teacher to correct. It was, I know this information, and I'm going to write it to this kid who wants to know this information. So that was very, very clear. Our table of contents began, well, we would have a chapter on cetaceans. Well, there's baleen whales and toothed whales. Well, let's have a chapter on whales and then a separate chapter on dolphins. Then, well, we needed a chapter for seals and walruses and so forth. And then those are pinnipeds, and we need a chapter on sirenians, the manatees and dugongs. Then sea otters, which are carnivores. And that was where we started. Then we added, as it went on, kids would say, well, I think our book needs, and so forth. And that's how the introductory chapter on what would the sea be like as home, and what is a mammal, and so forth, all that needed to go before this. And then man and marine mammals, and something about what yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and so forth. So that's how we structured it. And the kids simply started writing. And the there were no computers. I had an electric typewriter. When they had a draft, and by then they were well trained to read and respond to one another. A kid may have a draft here and have an idea in his or her head of what they have, but they have to know, have I succeeded? Is it here? So everybody knew how to work in response partners with somebody else to clarify what you're doing and so forth. And all of this is before issues of correctness of spelling and so forth come in. But one of the things in report, nonfiction, writing information that is always comes up is that students must be taught topic sentences. I didn't approach it like that. They had a structure within which to write, but they would come up against the need for a topic sentence. My favorite story is Oliver Orca, who is writing about, let's see, where is it, Jason? I think he's an English teacher now.
Did he ever go by Oliver Orca outside the class?
I'm not sure. Probably.
So what year was this book?
This is 78.
Okay.
So we've moved 10 years from 67. Oh, that's right. Oliver Orca had the quote, "How do toothed whales feed?" Okay. And he found the perfect topic sentence. All whales feed one way or the other.
No, or another.
Another, right. So then he could handle it. But it didn't come from my being up at the board saying, topic sentence, and this is why you need them. He had this, he couldn't figure out how to structure it. And then I remember talking to him about topic sentences, and he just went, yeah, and proceeded to write. Then the book also, all the time, kids, I kept, had them keep learning logs so that they had, they're writing their information, but then we would do various activities, and then I would have them do a learning log, and that would let me know what's going on, more information about what's going on. Let's see. I did the picking. I picked learning log entries, input and included. And then, of course, they're drawing all the time. And they're drawing what we're studying. And I'm reading to them, we read A Whale for the Killing by Farley Mowat. I read Sally Carragher's beautiful book about blue whales. We read, can't remember now, but all the time I'm reading things that were basically above their reading level but had all this information. So what are we going to do with the book? I knew about self-publishing, so we go to the Rotary Club, go to one of their meetings. Peter Palchis was superintendent then. And Peter knew what we were doing, and he got us a gig at the Rotary Club. So at this point, we were pretty much done. And kids dressed up. Whitney Wright wore a dress for the first time in her life. And we went over to the Rotary Club, and each kid would read them just a little bit of their, what they had. Maybe we only had 7 kids or 8 kids, but we're writing this book, and then they'd read this much. And if you want to know any more, you'll have to wait until our book is published and then turn around. So at the end of it, I was able to say, well, we need money to publish this. And so the Rotary Club gave us some money. I forget how much. It wasn't much. And they paid for the printing. And I don't even remember how many copies we need. But look at our bibliography. And, oh, Twilight Sea. That was the Carrigan book I read to them. But these were all the books in the room that we were reading and learning from. And every and the kids knew who was doing what. Because, of course, that was on a big chart, of who's doing, who has the responsibility for what part. And if a kid would find in one book something that, oh, I bet you could use some of this, and they'd...
So how many did you publish?
I don't remember. But then we sold them.
Oh, you did?
Okay. Oh, yeah, we sold them. We paid back the Rotary Club.
Oh, awesome.
We sold them for $5 a piece. We had a book, there's pictures in there, of the book party that we had. And there were some for sale at the Marine Mammal Center. There were some grandmother took a bunch to the Smithsonian in there. Some were there, and...
So how long, what else did you do in your career? Just summarize it.
After this year, I mean, this was very, very successful within the writing project and beyond. And so I did many, many presentations on that process. And... I had a friend who was getting a PhD in psychology right at this point. And when I showed her the cover drawing, she just looked at that and she said, Freud lives. Isn't that hilarious? So that, the success of this and what I was doing in the writing project enabled me to be selected for, I did a Fulbright
where?
Exchange in England, rural Wiltshire. And I was picked to be on a state assessment committee from the mid 80s through to the early 90s that was all about direct authentic assessment was what it was then called, away from multiple choice standardized testing to the first was a direct writing assessment where you actually, and that still takes place in many areas. Students are given prompts and they write and you work out a... There are rubrics that can be used that are standardized in the sense that the readers have to be trained, but where you can, and you have many, many sample responses, and on, say, a scale of 1 to 6, you're trained with so many papers that show what a 6 looks like, what a 5 looks like, what a 3, so that trained readers can simply read it. And, well, it's a 4. And that still takes place. But I was on a group that was, and we did succeed in creating statewide a direct reading and writing. So it was a 3-day test of reading real text, not something in, where students, you take real text from real books, not something generated by test makers, and they're written responses to questions that are open-ended, not right and wrong. The students were invited to take notes, to comment on the reading as they went along, and we had a rubric that measured the thought, the kind of thinking that was taking place. That took almost 5 years to create.
Now, were you teaching?
Yeah.
Okay, at the same time,
yeah.
This was
yeah.
Extracurricular job.
Right. And
you were still at Old Mill?
Yeah, I was at Old Mill during part of that, and then I was at Old Mill for 20 years and then went to Park. And while I was at Park, I was still going to Sacramento for working on that. But it became, that particular test became part of the culture wars as well.
Did that test have a name?
Yeah, it was the CLASS. It was an acronym, CLASS. And I don't remember what those letters stood for. But
could you define the culture war?
No. I mean, probably not very well off the top of my head right now. But what I mean by that is it was different. We weren't as statistically consistent with the reading test as we were with the writing. The writing worked, and it still is in, there still are direct writing systems. Took us a long time to get that rubric right. And there were some text selections that probably were not politically, they were a little too controversial or provocative. Because I think that's what you get, that's how you get responses, reading, good reading responses. But the whole reading assessment was, actually, in one, I wrote one. These are letters I got from students.
Again, this is after
that video, right. Where... Oh, I was telling Mark, but this is better. Because he's a professor at Penn State now, and he had written to me about the metrics of current assessment and how we don't measure what's important. And he said something about the industrial educational metrics that the data gatherers now assemble, unquote. And articulating what's important in education is so difficult. Quantifying it is even harder. And my involvement in the authentic assessment, helping this construct statewide direct writing assessments and literacy portfolios and even a reading comprehension test, where kids were asked to write, constructing their own meaning from text using a rubric that evaluated thinking rather than right answers, because we didn't have right and wrong answers. But that was very controversial, and it was on. I mean, I guess it was Pete Wilson, when he became governor, he killed it. But there were enough very conservative statewide assembly and senators that, anyway, some people got very, very exercised over what we were doing. And that, in retrospect, what made sense to me was that our basic assumption was that truth, right answers, truth does not reside in text. We felt it is instead in the meaning made between text and reader. But if truth does not reside in text, then that puts aside mm-hmm. any biblical belief in that kind of truth that is only in text. So I think that's why it was so controversial. Anyway, that's what I did for the next next few years.
And you retired when?
97. But my involvement in SS was statewide, but it was also, I think I was just hated by some teachers because I was always coming up with, let's have a new report card. And, just within Mill Valley School District, the report card traumas that we had, all the way from, even when Jim was still the superintendent, I talked everybody into having a narrative report card. Wrong name, a narrative is a story. No, but a blank paper where the teacher simply wrote to the parents that was too hard for everybody. And then we came, but that was the direction that got to benchmark, state standards, core curriculum, all of that came from from efforts to report learning in a way that isn't summative grades.
When I was a health educator and health counselor at Redwood High School, my concerns were things like anorexia, drug addiction, venereal disease, things like that, sex education. I found that the official films from the companies that got contracts with Washington on these subjects, the kids were much too sophisticated. This was in the 70s. They didn't fall for any of that official things that were handed down. And to reach the students, which my goal was to change behavior, because much of children's illnesses comes from their behavior. And I would have to get a recovered drug addict or somebody. I'd have someone real for them to really have validity with the kids. So they were already becoming more sophisticated. You were the beginning of something that maybe the officials didn't recognize it, but the kids were already on that level of understanding, I think.
They respond to being respected and being treated as individuals with minds and opinions.
Do you have any comments on special friendships or teachers, principals you totally admired that had an impact on you?
Well, I loved Jim Derrich, who has taught at, he has either taught or been principal of every school, elementary school in the district. He was my student teacher in 1968, I think we remember. And he's been wonderful. And when his first principal job was at Park, and that's why I left Old Mill, was to go to Park. And there were some years there that were better than any Old Mill years, where we really had a staff, an entire staff that worked together. I mean, we changed a report card into a really good report card, and we came up with a set of characteristics. We called them characteristics of a successful learner. And we made that part of the report card, and it was adopted by the whole district. And the years with Jim were wonderful. In my last few years teaching, then usually just fifth grade because we stopped having mixed grades, and I taught with Kathy Fisher from Green Gulch, and we were a perfect pair.
It sounds like you had a lot of joy in your classroom.
Oh, I loved it. Mm-hmm. I loved it. But I knew I didn't want to stay too long. Because you look around and you see teachers that have stayed too long. And when I stopped, when I realized, I didn't have as much excitement and joy with what the kids were doing. It told me it was time to go. I didn't want to stay too long.
Students that you particularly remember?
Oliver Orca. Oh, yes. Every one of these kids, very clearly. Many. I love walking into the Mill Valley Market and Brenda Chirk, mm-hmm. the clerk. Well, Brenda was in one of, she's in those pictures. I love seeing her. I love running into kids
But we parents were also part of the joy. There was a group of supportive parents that we were resonating with what you brought to this.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Wonderful parents. Yeah.
Like Dar Chirk, pro bono, did a whole, built a whole playground for for kindergarten kids so they could feel safe.
And it saddens me so much that at Old Mill you can't even go in the lower door anymore. You can't. When they redid the school, because every classroom had a back door. You could just go outside. Those are gone. You can't have that anymore. You can't be in a school without your name tag, without signing in at the office and having a name tag on.
And security.
Yeah.